Blog Talk Radio.
When you don't go to Geico.com, car insurance can be confusing. Like Swedish techno confusing.
Bark, bark, meow, meow. Dance with me, purple cow. Bark, bark, meow, meow. Ooh, you lovely cow.
Geico makes it easy. With 24/7 access, all you have to do is go to Geico.com and you could save money on car insurance. It just makes sense. Unlike, you know.
Dance with me, purple cow. I like your moves.
Blog Talk Radio.
Few Americans truly understand our prison system.
Prisoners under the 13th Amendment essentially work as
in a form of neo-slavery.
End mass incarceration.
Millions for prisoners, human rights.
March on Washington, August 2017.
No Shackles Radio.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of No Shackles Radio. I am Crystal and your host for this evening. Thank you for tuning in once again. Here at No Shackles Radio, we are committed to protecting prisoners' human rights, re-educating the people about the 13th Amendment and its effects, as well as organizing for the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March on Washington. I am joined this evening by my co-host. First, I'd like to introduce Mama Condi.
Good evening and welcome, everybody. And thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Mama Condi. Brother Malar Divine.
Peace, peace, peace. You know I'm the prisoner's champion on deck one.
Thank you so much, and we have Sister Layla Aziz with us this evening. How are you doing, Layla?
Peace and blessings, everyone, and thank you for joining.
Thank you so much, and we are delighted to have our special guest with us this evening, Rebecca Hensley.
Hi, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm really excited.
Thank you so much, Rebecca, and stay tuned. Later on in our program this evening, we will have an opportunity to get into a great discussion with Rebecca, so stay tuned. But as always, we do like to start off our radio broadcast with any updates on any recent police killings. Unfortunately, here in this country, and I did just want to let you know that as of yesterday, October 14th, there have been 913 people killed by police this year. And so I would like to mention a few of those names of these individuals that have been killed by police since October 10th, just, you know, over the last, so this is really over a four-day period of time. We have a Devin Desnoyers, age 26, killed on October 10th. He was from Ohio. We have a Thomas Burns, age 49, October 10th. He was killed. He's from Arizona. We have a Kanav Little Dog, age 19 years old, killed October 10th in Texas. We have a Mauricio Barron, age 27, killed October 10th in California. Dennis Hunt, age 56, killed October 10th in North Carolina. On October 10th as well, we have a Tavon Jenkins, as well as a Cassandra Marie Braun, both age 26, killed on October 10th. On October the 11th, we have a Michael Taylor, age 44, killed on October the 11th in Washington State. We have a Dominique Musliman, age 30, killed October the 11th in California. A Blaine Justin Beeson, age 31, October 12th in Louisiana. Kirk Figueroa, age 30, killed October 12th in Massachusetts. Matthew Brewer, age 22, killed October 12th in Kentucky. Rex Van Wilson, age 50, killed October 12th in Nevada. Sean Pape, age 46, killed October 13th in Oregon. We have a Chaz York, age 23, killed October 14th in Texas. And then a George Zapata, age 24, killed yesterday, October 14th in Texas. That's a lot of names. That is a lot of names. That only covers the last 5 days. So as you can see, we have got a epidemic, a mass crisis here of police violence, brutalities, and killings. And so, you know, we always want to highlight here police brutality because it's all related. It encompasses the human rights violations, the issues that we are so strongly trying to challenge at No Shackles Radio with the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights Organizing Committee. This is also a focus of the march itself. So, again, I do like to take a moment each show to update us on that. Find ways to challenge that, definitely. But moving along, in some other news, many of you are familiar with the Free Alabama Movement. You know, they were some of the lead organizers with the September 9th strikes that we just witnessed. As an update, in Alabama, Kinetic Justice, you know, he was one of the lead organizers. This past week, he was moved to another facility in retaliation for reporting the human rights violations that are going on in the Alabama prison system. And but due to the actions taken by the prisoners there in Alabama, the DOJ has now open up an investigation of the Alabama Department of Correction. And so I'll just say that this definitely goes to show the significance of prisoners' voices. You know, they must always be included in the conversation that we're having. And so we highlight those prisoners' voices here. But definitely, this is why, you know, the prison officials, they're doing all that they can to keep the prisoners quiet. So we do want to be a voice for them. Let me just also give you an update on the situation. A few weeks ago, we reported here that Brother Jaleel Musa King, he was also being retaliated against for supporting the Millions for Prisoners Human Rights March. And, you know, he was writing people, organizations, encouraging people to participate in this right here. And unfortunately, because of that, you know, he was given a disciplinary charge. Well, we did learn over the past week or so that those charges were dismissed. And I will definitely say that this came because of the amount of phone calls, the pressure that we all collectively put on that prison system is what really caused that change. You know, we put a call out there for you all to call And we thank you again for that. So a lot of our supporters, as well as other organizations, you know, they really came out in support. And that, you know, definitely is a testament what to, you know, that's something small that we can do on a small scale. So could you even imagine what we can do when we all get together and we challenge this 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution? But the fight is not over. Now the New York Department of Correction is they're trying other tactics to keep Brother Jahlil and other prisoners quiet. In particular, they are now saying that he is not allowed to correspond with any organizations outside of New York State, which, of course, you know, we know that that's a constitutional violation. But so I guess that's some bittersweet news, but we'll go with the good of that situation and to be continued on that particular situation. I did want to take a moment to allow my co-host this evening to get in on a little discussion here about the movie, the documentary that came out last Friday, the 13th. And, you know, we were all so excited. Everybody's been promoting this movie. Everybody's been, you know, it's been such the big talk, this 13th movie. I saw it. I had a chance to view it. I thought it was well done, well written, a great documentary in and of itself. You know, myself in particular, if I had to give any critique to the movie, I would definitely say that, you know, it offered really no solution. You know, it kind of stopped, in my opinion, it stopped short of encouraging people to do something about it or to, you know, focus on the 13th Amendment. They're not saying go, you know, come together, address this law, take it out of our Constitution, let's abolish prisons. You know, they're not offering any long-term concrete solution to this situation. But that would be my critique. Others have expressed concern or I'm going to say an awareness that the film appeared in some people's opinion to promote certain propaganda, certain political agendas and ideas. But overall, I think it was a great documentary. I would still definitely encourage everyone, if possible, to check that out. At this time, I do want to. I'm so sorry. I'm hearing a little bit of noise in the background. I am going to just ask everyone to mute their line if your line is not muted. All right. Thank you so much. I wanted to ask my co-host this evening, any feelings, any thoughts, if you've seen it, if you've heard anything about it. Take it away, Brother Malala Vaughn. What are your thoughts on that?
I've seen the documentary. I think as far as, like, it was a good introductory understanding. If you didn't know anything about the 13th Amendment, if you didn't know anything about the convict leasing program. So I think that on that level, that it served its purpose. But looking forward to providing the solutions. Had it did, it wouldn't have been on Netflix. You know, mainstream media is not going to tell people to get involved or become active. That's not their duty or their job. So, but as far as those that didn't know anything, I think that, you know, it was pretty good. It was well done, which was surprisingly, you know, and it still showed that, okay, this is the concept of the 13th Amendment. This is what happened. Basically, it transferred slavery from being personal property to being property of the state. So, and technically, they didn't really get rid of slavery. So I think that from that aspect, it served its purpose. Peace.
Thank you. Mama Condi. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Mama Condi. I was going to ask Layla if she had an opportunity to view that movie and what were her thoughts about it.
I agree. It was definitely a primer. It definitely gave people who had no understanding, which is the majority of people in the United States and in other countries who are watching, the knowledge that slavery is still very much alive and legal. It didn't really go in depth, but it purposely didn't really go in depth. It opened up a dialogue, so it suited its purpose.
Mm-hmm.
It entwined slavery, then the Black Codes, then Jim Crow, and then mass incarceration. And it showed how they were relationally all entwined in upholding slavery, a caste system, and criminality. It did not go in depth in demonstrating how this keeps entire groups economically, politically, and basically humanely disenfranchised. Right now,
mm-hmm.
To that degree, how it stops from housing when people who get out of, like, touched on some of those things a little bit, but it didn't go in depth. How entire voting blocks for people who are incarcerated and released are not able, they're disenfranchised, and how the basic elements that each group traditionally fought for women's suffrage, the civil rights movement, all of these things are basically taken away through the criminal clause. You can't get jobs. There's now severe background checks to go to Home Depot. And so what does
mm-hmm.
that do economically? A whole demographic. So it started, but it didn't really get in depth in how that's really impacting us on the ground.
Definitely. Definitely. I agree with that. I do. And Mama Condi, I know that you have not actually seen the movie itself, but you've got such a wealth of knowledge and experience and history with these things. I was just wondering if you had any input or any light that you'd like to shed on this topic.
It's interesting because, as you said earlier, the 13th Amendment and addressing that issue and how it's been adapted from enslavement to imprisonment is being viewed internationally in a very interesting way. I've had the opportunity to talk to some of the brothers and sisters who are a part of the military, and they travel all over the globe, and they're saying that a lot of people in other countries are looking at this issue and others and how we are being treated in this country, and they see it, they're viewing it as we're in civil war in this country.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the world is looking at us. That's how they see us. And on a more personal note, my son was taken from me by the state and children's services under the pretext of protecting him from me. It took me 4.5 years to fight the case and win. And what I learned after doing research into my case is that when they take your child ends up with what ultimately is an arrest record. They issue an arrest card. That's like the initial introduction for that child into the prison system. So I'm sure this film did not even allude to what I'm sharing, and that's unfortunate
mm-hmm.
because there's so many aspects of this struggle that need to be presented and addressed. Thank you.
Thank you. I agree, Mama Condi. And you know, that's terrible, you know, what happened to your grandson that you mentioned. And unfortunately, you know, we hear that similarity so often, you know, especially if we get into this whole school-to-prison pipeline. And what that reality for so many demographics and classes of people here in this country. But as you mentioned, it all ties back into the 13th Amendment. So if you have not seen this documentary, check it out. It's on Netflix. It's called The 13th. And let us know what you think about it. I do want to let all of our listeners know this evening that if you would like to get in on our conversation, you press the 1 on your phone, and that will add you to our queue, and we will certainly get to your question. So at this point in our show, I would like to tell you about our special guest this evening. Her name is Rebecca Hensley. And again, thank you so much for agreeing to be a part of this program this evening, Rebecca. Thank you for sharing your experience and insight with our host and our listening audience as well. I'll do a brief, you know, something, but I will definitely allow you to tell our audience more about yourself. But Rebecca, she is a professor of sociology. She is a social change agent and author, a human rights act advocate. So we're thrilled. She has been in this movement for a long time, and so she's got quite the experience and insight that we are very anxious to hear this evening. So thank you again, Rebecca, for joining us. I will let you share with us. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you want us to know.
Okay, Crystal. I'm very excited about this for several reasons. I'm processing 13th here. I haven't had time to watch it yet, although I have it on my Netflix queue. But one of the reasons I haven't forced myself to make time yet is that I'm so often disappointed that I either walk away from these things really depressed because they really did a great job of explaining it, and I remember all the details, and it takes me back to all the other things I know to add to that. Or it disappoints me so much that, as you point out, as you all pointed out, there are no solutions offered, but more importantly, they don't even address a lot of the specifics that really make it the monster that it is. So I just want to make that comment. But I appreciate this opportunity, and Crystal, you and I had talked about what I might be able to share with people that might be valuable to those who are in the movement now. I want to make the point of saying that I have known and worked with a lot of committed people for 45 years in the prison abolition movement, but my personal story is the only one I know. It's the one I know the best. So I'm going to talk about what I've seen and what I've been a part of, but I don't want anybody to misconstrue that I'm just talking like I am the walrus cuckoo-cuckoo. I'm not. I only just saw certain things through my own eyes and with other people, and some of them I'm not sure are entirely wanting me to put them out there, so that's one of the reasons I'm doing it the way I am. But we talked about my history and the history of the movement. So I'll start by saying that I first heard about prisons and what was going on in prisons in 1970 when I was in a collective in San Francisco. It was an underground newspaper collective, and a guy named Popeye Jackson came by and told us about the California Prisoners Union. And it was the first time I'd ever been exposed to anything about prison. I was in my mid-20s, and I was fascinated. I was really into it. So when I went a few months later to Iowa City, Iowa, to visit a friend, and I ran across a collective of people there who had already kicked off doing prison abolition work, I jumped to be a part of it. They had a newspaper at the time called the Penal Digest International, But within a matter of months, we had changed it to the Prisoners Digest International in solidarity with the people inside. And then it was also, we had a thing called the National Prison Center, and that operated out of Iowa City. And I was there for the better part of 4 years, 24 hours a day. That was all I did. And I never gave it up after that. So that's been 45 years ago. I thought originally I was just going to be a layout artist because I knew how to do that, and we were talking about a newspaper. But it was a new collective in many ways, and so they had wound up with two gigantic boxes of unopened mail from the prison. I mean, these boxes were just overflowing with unopened mail. So I just sat down and I just started answering letters, and I did nothing else until those boxes were empty. And by the time they were empty, we had started to get so much mail out of prisons and jails that on a given day, we might get as many as 70 letters from all over the country. And some of them would have stuff in it for print, like they were looking for pen pals, or they were sending poems or essays or articles or cartoons or artwork. They would report conditions. They would report situations. They would report their whereabouts, because sometimes they would be snatched in the middle of the night and nobody would know where they were. It was a time when there was starting to be activity in the prisons. And so people would disappear and they would write to us. They would kite out a letter to us, and we would make sure that other people knew where they were, and that, and they would say, don't let me die and nobody know where I am. It was just very intense for us to be a part of that. So at that time, when we felt like we didn't know how many others there were other papers, there were other collectives, there were other actions, but you were so busy that half the time you didn't have an opportunity to interface with those people. As we got input from the prisons, we would get these letters that would say, I'm number 27 on the list to read so-and-so's copy of the PDI. And by tallying all those kinds of statements, as best we could tell, we were probably being read by maybe even 50,000 readers or more. I mean, it was shocking, you know, that how quickly people were getting on to interfacing. You have to remember that we had no social media, we had no blog, we had no cell phones with video capability. You know, we had mail, and a lot of that was being badly tampered with. But we had the paper, so when people would ask for legal advice, we started printing entire legal decisions in the paper, so that when it went inside, and we would use this teeny tiny little font size, so we could get the whole thing in there, so that people had access to it. Eventually, we actually got a jailhouse lawyer to join our collective just for the purpose of writing all the people back who were needing really solid stuff. I thought you might be interested in how we financed what we were doing. Some collective members worked at day jobs to support the collective. Prisoners who had money, and some of them did, supported us. I got a settlement, or I was supposed to get an insurance settlement for a car wreck I was in one time, and I borrowed against that settlement and contributed, I don't even remember how many thousand dollars, but I don't remember, but it was a lot, to the collective. And then at one point, the Department of Justice actually paid the National Prison Center $7,000 to write a chapter of a task force report on county jail conditions, because they claimed that with all the information we had coming in, we probably knew more about it than they did. So, I mean, it was that, it was just wherever we could grab money at the time, that's how we stayed afloat. And we were heavily in debt when we went belly up anyway, which I'm not sure how that even was accomplished because of the work we were doing. But to give you another example of what was happening in the overall movement, it wasn't for us, but we did go there. The Ford Foundation actually gave another organization $100,000 to organize a national prisoners conference in Portland, Oregon in June of 1972 for groups from all over the country to come to, and we did. There was probably, I don't know how many groups exactly, but I know we filled up the main congregation area of a large church. So there must have been at least a couple hundred or maybe 300 people there, with on average probably five or six people from each group. So that's a lot of groups that were represented at that conference. But right away it became apparent that there were some internal conflicts, different ideas about what needed to be done. And we were pushing organizing for change, organizing in solidarity with the prisoners to make mass structural change and abolish the prisons. That's where we were coming from. So we managed to talk everybody into forming a national prisoners coalition, which was supposed to go into all the prisoners and make it possible for people in different prisons and jails to sign up with the national prisoners coalition to represent them, to make it like a union so we could speak as a mass voice, kind of what you're doing with the Million Prisoners March in Washington. But that's what we were trying to kick off. And when we toured the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem right after the conference, I mean, just the minute the conference was over, we got to they let us in to do a tour of the penitentiary in Salem. And when we came out, somebody had slipped one of us a piece of paper in our armpit saying the following 20-something people want the National Prisoners Coalition to represent them. And it hadn't even hit the media yet. So I don't know. That's the kind of solidarity that was occurring, and that's what kept us pushing. We also tried to apply for a permission to establish a National Prisoners Credit Union. We thought if prisoners could put like $50 into a National Credit Union, Prisoners Credit Union, then if their families got in trouble, their families could apply for a loan to do whatever because they were a member. But we were denied based on the fact that we were told prisoners are not a class, which is, of course, ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Of course they're a class. So we were trying everything. But what we were focusing on more than anything else at that moment was the behavioral modification programs that were, they were everywhere, but they were particularly strong in Springfield, Missouri, in the federal medical facility there, in Marion, Illinois, where they had a lot of political prisoners, in El Reno, where they had a lot of young people, and eventually in North Carolina at Butner, where the Federal Center for Correctional Research was taking all the ugliest techniques and doing them there. So we were really, really pushing that. And we did help to close the program in Springfield because we had heard from prisoners that there were prisoners in there chained naked to the grill of their beds with no mattress. They were forced to eat on the floor with their hands handcuffed behind them. They were on psychotropics. It was a nightmare. And so we just pushed and pushed and pushed, and they finally closed the special treatment and rehabilitative training program, which was called the START program at Springfield, in 1974, saying that it was because it wasn't cost-effective. What we believed that it was a lot of people trying to draw attention to it that caused it to be closed down. Basically, our core group was a bunch of ordinary people who were on fire with commitment to close the prison. I remember one guy getting on a stage at a huge rock concert one time, commandeering the microphone and making a plea so impassioned on behalf of the prisoners that nobody even made him get off the stage till he was done. Yet it was clear that the average U.S. citizen did not care about what was going on in the prison and jails, did not care, and did not care when we told them. In late 1971, a huge movement started within the movement, and it was it came to us through a letter from the Church of the New Song in Georgia. They told us that they had claimed First Amendment protection as a church, that they had gone to court, and did we want to be a part of it? And we said, let us know what the ruling is. And in February of 1972, Judge Newell Edenfield ruled in their favor, and we became the outside headquarters for that church. So we soon had church groups, we called them purlieus, with special rectorates. That was people that were, you know, made ministers inside, all over the country. And it became, now, if you look it up online, they'll call it a gang. It was not a gang. The solidarity was so powerful across all lines inside that what they would do is they would have a minister in each group in the prison, and then those ministers would meet every week and talk about whatever issues had come up, whatever needed to be addressed, and they did that without a guard present because they were under the First Amendment of the Constitution. They couldn't be held incommunicado. Anybody who was their minister of record, their chaplain of record, could see them even if they were in the hole. Legally, you couldn't keep anyone away from their chaplain of record. And so that was one of the reasons we got involved in it, because we were so excited about the potential for how many of the people that we were already working with that were so involved in organizing prisoners inside and were going through so much pain and difficulty, we could stay in contact with them in that way. So when some people went full-time with that movement in the church, I was one of those people. To show you how it worked on one occasion, I went to Leavenworth to ask to see a prisoner named Joseph Harry Brown. And Joseph Harry Brown was one of our ministers, and I was his chaplain of record, so they could not keep me out. I went, I asked to see him. The chief of classification and parole, whose name was Witkowski, told me to leave. I didn't, and I infuriated him so badly that he actually ordered 6 goons to pick me up at shoulder height, carry me out the front door, carry me to the top of the Leavenworth steps, which are like 20 long concrete steps, and threatened to throw me down. I thought they were going to throw me down. They ultimately didn't do it. I left. Brown was moved to Marion in Illinois, so that would move the case. I went to Marion and asked to see him so we could go into court in Illinois. That's the way we kept it going. In the meantime, by 1973, we had gone into the Iowa State Penitentiary at Fort Madison, which was the closest maximum security men's penitentiary to us, every Sunday, where the Protestant services would have like 22 people and the Catholic service might have 17 people out of 750 or so prisoners. And we would have our service, and there'd be 467 prisoners at our service. And that's what we were doing. And again, no social media, no blogs, no cell phones, no nothing, just mail and commitment. It was about that time then that a 55-year-old prisoner, I don't remember his name, I don't even remember the prison, but I think it probably was the federal joint, was beaten severely, dragged down the tier so everybody would see him. Everybody knew he was one of our members, not one of the ministers, just a member. And he died in the hole without medical care. So the message I got was that our opponents were absolutely ruthless. They would do anything to stop whatever headway we could make. And two, they apparently saw prisoners and people on the outside organizing together against the prisons as a threat bad enough to be willing to take lives. I never forgot that. I never got over it, and I never forgot it. Because I know that to this day, like what went down in what has been going down all summer all over the country, and particularly in Alabama, has indicated that we're still there. We're still in that space. The last few weeks that I was involved with the collective, I went into Fort Madison 7 days a week by court order. And some other people had already been doing it in the collective for about a year, but they needed a break, and I had already burned to a crisp and left the collective, but they asked me to come back and give them a break. So I came back for about 6 or 8 weeks and went in by court order every day because they could not keep us out. Since we had more ministers, I mean more parishioners, more church members than anybody else, they had to give us an office. They had to give us a clerk typist. They had to give us access to the men in the hole. They had to let us write parole reports. They had to let us see anybody in the prison body. And on one particular night, they actually called us at night where we were in the middle of the night and told us they were afraid there was about to be a riot because of somebody that was really ill and they hadn't taken care of him. And we told them what to do and who to talk to. And they called us to ask about that. It was astounding. They asked for help. The nighttime sergeant asked for help to keep it from blowing up. And that can happen or could happen then, and I think even more so now when we have so many more options, so many more resources is what I mean. Since that time, through the 45 years since I left that collective, I've written for mass media, spoken, talked, worked on cases, organized conferences, visited prisoners. Most recently, I visited Albert Woodfox for 7 years before he was freed in February after 43 years in the hole because of his Black Panther organizing in Angola Penitentiary here in Louisiana. I've even worked in the field, counseling, training, designing programs, training others. And for the past 10 years, I've blogged on race at whyaminotsurprised.blogspot.com. If you go on my website, which is called RebeccaHensley.com, you can find Why Am I Not Surprised. It has over 600 posts. All of it's about race. Probably at least 60 to 75 of the posts are on aspects of the criminal justice system and prison. It has been read in almost 200 countries, and it has had over 600,000 hits. So that's how the person that said that people all over the world are watching us. They are watching us. They want to see what are we doing, what is happening, what are we doing to resist, to make headways, to change the way things are. And so regardless of how disappointing the 13th is, the fact that it's trending on Netflix for me is very exciting. And the Millions for Prisoners March being planned for next year and all these activities happening all over the world that are linking the outside to the prisoners and the prisoners to each other is reminding me that all the people that died and all the people that are still there who have never been able to leave and all the people who got out and died because they weren't able to live an ordinary life because of what had been done to them, have all been waiting for this day, and I am so grateful I have gotten to see it with my own two eyes. Thank you so, so much for your work. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you so much, Rebecca. That was, you know, great to just sit back and listen to you and your experiences. And, wow, so much history there. And, you know, I couldn't help but think that, you know, so many of the things that you mentioned that were taking place back then in the 70s, those are some of the similar things. You know, the prison system has not really evolved much. In terms of the inhumane conditions that you speak of. So I definitely want to applaud you on the work that you have put in and the work that you continue to put in. I did have an opportunity to check out your blog, Why Am I Not Surprised? And I must tell you, check it out, everybody. That this is a super great blog. I mean, it covers so many topics and discussion, everything from, you know, privilege to racism to, you know, the prison resistance movement. And I do want to say I know that you have a knowledge and experience of your advocacy work around the time of the Attica prison riot that took place, you know, back in 1971. I just wanted to see if you could give us a little brief something about that.
Well, to be honest with you, that was during my time when I was locked in the basement with the letters trying to answer them, because we were doing so many things in so many places. I was oblivious to some of them, but I will tell you what we our part of what we did. At that time, we had a guy outside Attica while it was shut down who was taking photographs, who was getting information. He was part of, we were part of the press because we were the Prisoners Digest International. And we brought out an issue that was 70 pages long, jam full of photos, jam full of articles, full of, you know, first person accounts of various things, everything that we could put in there. And then, of course, we had people in Attica because we had all kinds of people in New York that were part of our connected group. And so we tried to send the issues in to the guys who had, subscriptions. And any prisoner could get a free subscription by just writing and asking for it. So we went to send those in. And, of course, the administration said, you can't, we won't let these in. We won't allow these to be delivered. And so we went to court and we forced them to take those in to the prison in court, because of course it was First Amendment rights. It was the freedom of the press. And so they had to let those issues. It took a while, but we got them in there eventually. And so I had absolutely nothing to do with that, but I was really proud that I was connected to the collective as it made that happen, and that historically we had played our role, the only role we could play in that. Thanks for
all
asking.
Right. Thank you so much, Rebecca. I do want to remind the callers that if you would like to get in on the discussion, I'll be opening up the lines shortly. Remember to press the 1 on your phone. But prior to that, I wanted to check in. I want to allow our co-host this evening to get in on the discussion. Mama Kondi, Layla, Brother Malah Divine, if you have questions for Rebecca or comments or anything that you share with us this evening, we'd love to hear it.
Yes, I do. I would like to ask, what do you feel is the biggest change from the 1970 movement until now, 2016?
That's a wonderful question, and I thought of it when I was listening to you guys talk when you were first opening up. I wrote down the thing that I said about no social media, no blogs and all that, because that's no question the biggest thing. I mean, the social media is so huge. Facebook, Twitter, the blogs, the cell phones with video capacity, you know, that come out with all the things, and even Netflix, you know, the ability for people to access information in a whole range of ways, even if it's not, I mean, like you were talking earlier about 13th being a way for people who haven't been exposed to maybe slavery by another name or some of the other stuff that's come out about those kinds of issues. And I've been reading A People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn, and he's got a chapter in there that outlines the prison movement from before the 70s all the way up. And it's very moving to see how long we've been struggling with exactly the same issues. Just like Crystal said, the issues are the same. They may come up with something like behavioral modification, or they may come up with ways of attacking people in new ways. They may, you know, they keep coming up with ways to counter resistance, but social media has made possible the real potential to bring not only the prison movement, I think, not only the prison movement into an exciting new era of effectiveness, but also to build solidarity between the prison abolition movement and other movements. You know, whether that's Black Lives Matter, or whether that's what's going on at Standing Rock, or whether that's women who are moving for you know, trans, all kinds of issues that are on the outside looking in for the capitalist powers that be. Who are making money from us and are always quick to say there are no other options, there are no other alternatives, which is, I think, the most dangerous thing. If the 13th does not offer solutions, then the most dangerous message that is delivered by that is that there are no other alternatives, that we're just stuck with what we've got. And that is a lie. That is a bold-faced lie, and we know it. And making that information available through social media can raise consciousness and give people hope, which is not just people inside, but all of us. Give us hope.
Definitely. I want to ask you one more question. You talk about you was part of the collective back in the day. For those of us that's maybe of a younger age, what do you mean by that term collective?
That's an important question. Wow, thank you. I didn't even think to explain that. Of course, I knew I was going to talk so much, I was trying to jam everything in. But a collective, there's two words that popped up in the 1960s and 70s. One of them was commune. And commune comes from the same root word as communist, not to sound scary, but commune just means a bunch of people that live together. They can live together and all work in different places or whatever, because it's expensive to live by yourself. They might not have any particular interest in the same things, except that they live in the same space. But a collective is a group of people who work together to make things happen, whatever those are. Now, that doesn't have to be a social change movement, for example. That might just be a collective of people who want to create artwork for sale in their shop, or it might be a collective of people who want to have a daycare that's available to a lot of women and men who don't have access to good low-cost daycare, and they form a collective to have a daycare or something like that. But there can also be a collective that is dedicated without apology to social change in one direction or another. And in our particular case, we were a commune and a collective. And at one point, we were a collective living in two communes because we filled two houses. And we were pretty much jammed in. At one point, one of the houses had 31 people in it. And a number of them were ex-prisoners who had come. One guy hitchhiked all the way from Atlanta, Georgia, to us in Iowa City to see what we were up to and to make sure we were doing what we said we were doing on behalf of the prisoners. I mean, it was we were held accountable. But a collective is a group of people who are committed, and a lot of times the reason they might live together is because it's just cost efficient. You know, that way you don't have to come up with as much money, and you can and you see each other. You have discussions all the time. Of course, when you do that, it means you're doing it 24/7. I mean, it's really hard to ever lay it down when it's in your face continuously. But which risks burnout. But on the other hand, depending on how deep in you are, this is a style of resistance action that's been going on at least since the French Revolution, and I'm assuming since a lot longer than that. So this is not new news. This is just what humans do who are standing against those who are in power, oppressive forces.
Thank you, Rebecca. This is Layla. Mama Condi, did you have anything for Rebecca before I ask a question? Because just with the commune and the collective, I know your vast experience and what you've done.
You're so naughty. hi, Rebecca. How are you?
Elder first.
How you doing, Rebecca?
I'm well, thank you. I'm very well, thank you. A little intimidated by you, but other than that.
Oh,
anybody who's called Mama makes me respectful. Let me just put it that way.
I'm the elder in this collective, and so that's probably why. And I've earned it. May I ask your age?
I'm 70 years old.
Bless your heart. I knew you had to be of some substantial age because you were talking about in the 70s and what you were doing in the 70s. And
right.
My introduction to working with those in the prisons was with Falaka Fatah. She was well known in Philadelphia for her work in the behind the walls and helping folk who were coming out and trying to get back acclimated back into the system
and
into the community. When you mentioned the word community, I love words. I really love words. And one of the, when you say community and collective, I know that the term group is like group and tribe are kind of trivializing, and community and collective allow for an expansion and an enormity of those who come together to achieve a specific goal. And the word community originally was ka, which is spirit, and mu, which is the mu or more or Lemuria. That's the root for that particular word. So I enjoyed that. I'm the one who was talking about the international perspective of what's going on in this country. You said someone mentioned that. That was me.
Right.
I was the one who mentioned that. And I guess my question to you is, how do you see what's happening now as a growth, outgrowth, progression, regression of what was happening back when you and I were working in this fight for prisoners?
Wow. I have to say that it's really important to see young people coming up now, and over the whole 45 years that I've been doing this, if I didn't see young people stepping up, my heart would have broken a long time ago, because they keep me focused, and they keep me, and I know many other people, going forward, because we know that this is not a sprint, it's a marathon. And I think it's very important that another of the points that was made earlier was this is not just about prisons. I think Crystal, when she first opened, said we understand that police brutality and the criminal justice system in general and all kinds of aspects of oppression in our society are all of a piece. They're all connected for the purpose of maintaining control. And it's, on one hand, it's terrifying, because these people are not playing. They absolutely will destroy everything that breathes to stay in control. The reality is that they have not broken the spirit of the prisoners. They have not run off all the people on the outside who are connected to them and who choose to form a bond with them. And as we go forward to change the way things are, not just in this country, but internationally, as we listen to people like Arundhati Roy say, another world is possible. I can hear her breathing. You know, we hear Angela Davis say, it's not supposed to be like this. I grab hold of that stuff and I just cling to it. And so I think that everything that's happening now is a natural outgrowth of oppression being unwilling to let go of its power and its control, and then getting more violent because it sees it's already lost. That doesn't mean we've won. It means they've lost. They know that they cannot maintain it because they cannot kill us all. And we continue to go forward in that knowledge, no matter what it means.
And the last thing I wanted to say to you is I'm familiar with the strategy of all the ministers. When you look at my website and you look at my history, I am a reverend. I didn't become a reverend because of any religious reason. I became a reverend because I realized, along with others who did the same thing I did, we could get more accomplished in the prison system as
That's
a reverend
right.
with a church than we could as just regular people. So that's why a lot of us are reverends now. And I
Absolutely.
Thank you for your comment. You're precious. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mama.
And Professor Hensley, I know we want to get to questions. I just wanted to say, first of all, I did get a chance to read your book, Reduced to Equality. I love the name. And how you speak of things. One of the quotes, I'm going to tell you first, this is rhetorical. My favorite quote of your book is, inciting a riot is illegal. Inciting a murder is not. And that's what we're seeing on the ground right now with the
that's
police
right.
department,
that's right.
with the racist who, we had a young person who was hit by a car during a protest yesterday, and the police watched them get hit. And then when the protesters apprehended the vehicle, that's when we stepped in.
And so we're seeing a whole social kind of like where they're saying, basically, if people are out there and they're protesting, kill them. One of the, and then another part you touched on when you talked about Hurton, and he wrote that an entire generation of black youth would eventually manifest what he called the psychology of the damned.
Right.
He warned that they would be unreasonable, unwilling, and unable to negotiate, and dangerous because they would, he predicted, see themselves as having nothing to lose. George Jackson wrote about that in his story about with suppression and hard suppression. And you started your book, and this is what I want to talk to you about, is but one of the many things that I learned going into the prisons was that the numbers of African Americans compared to others was absolutely shocking. One had either to believe that African Americans were unprincipled, rapscallions, widely incapable of socially acceptable behavior, or one had eventually to believe that the criminal justice system across the board in every state in the union was shot through the institutionalized oppression against people of color in general and African Americans most particularly. I look at that and I'm seeing a lot of the things you witnessed in the 70s. I wasn't born until the latter 70s, but from the Vandemos organization out of the Bay to the George Jackson Brigade to a lot of organizations, and you speak of whites who stepped in and tried to explain white privilege. And what is, and I'm dealing with a lot of organizations like that here on the ground. What can you say to experience? Because I'm not into reinventing the wheel. Where did we fail? Why is there lapse? And what can we do to prevent that future failure of this prison movement, of the abolitionist movement?
Oh, Lord. Oh, dear. Oh, wow.
I feel you.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I've only had 45 years to think about this. So
yes.
I can't begin to answer that very cleverly, but I will tell you two things that came to mind while you were leading up to the question. Was that you mentioned me going in there and seeing all these black faces and how stunned I was, and there was no doubt about it. I mean, I could not get my brain around what I was looking at, and the fact that nobody on the outside was really discussing this, not even in the black community, in voices that I could hear. And so I didn't know where to start because even though we were talking about prisons and prisoners, we were not talking about that. And I was saying, wait a minute. And then this other thing that I saw, a quote, I don't remember, I think the book was some really old book on criminal justice or something, and it said, the criminal code is the line between the state and the public. And so that really stabbed me, because what it said to me was that the state, the government, you know, is the control mechanism for those who have the actual power in the society. And the public is everybody else. So if that's the case, the first message I got from that sentence was, I've got one foot in prison. Because if the line is the criminal code, and if I am going to make myself a criminal by doing things that challenge power, then I could go to prison at any point. So that was the first message I got. But because I had already seen this sea of black faces inside the penitentiaries, I combined that with the idea that, you know, this line, fine line between the state and the public, and I thought, now what in particular does the state, does the government does the capitalist power structure, what is it doing to black people on purpose? Why is it doing this? What is happening here that is that we are not talking about as much as we need to? Because white supremacy, I've given up talking about racism and I talk about white supremacy. I talk about, because when I talk about racism, somebody will say, well, you know, anybody can be racist, but I talk about white supremacy and everybody looks at the floor because you can't argue with it. And it's so apparent and it's so everywhere in our society and so deep and so wide and so obnoxious. So in the prisons, we've got this white supremacy going on because those who have the power, those who are making the decisions, those who are making the money are making it on the backs of black people like they always have. And here in Louisiana, they do it in plantation form. They ride horseback and carry shotguns and have the workers in the field tilling crops they don't even get to eat. It's horrifying. And so we've got this, and I think that one thing we really need to do is keep coming back over and over to the white supremacist foundation of the whole prison system, because that's what built it. That was the whole thing. As people have already made the point, not tonight, but I mean the point has been well made in a number of ways, that the whole police force kind of concept came out of the slaves, the people that were riding the roads to look for slaves. And so if we want to, it doesn't matter how far back in history we want to go to find the basis of the criminal justice system, which has slowly but surely morphed into the prison system as a section of it, only one section of it, but a very horrendous, important section of it, a very expensive section of it. We need to constantly make sure that we underscore and highlight the way this whole system, this whole, the criminal justice system as a whole is white supremacist in nature, because sometimes people want to say, even academic people, especially white people, want to say that white people don't understand, and that's crap. They know exactly what's going on. They don't want to know. It's painful. They're overwhelmed. They feel guilty and awful and they don't know what to do and they don't know how to fix it and they don't want to lose anything that they pretend they don't think they have, but they know they have it or they wouldn't worry about losing it. And that must be challenged, and it can be challenged because they know it's not true. I do a lot of that in the classroom. I do a lot of it, and it makes people crazy. It makes people crazy, but it's crucial. And I think that this is, you know, sometimes we want to be careful about that because we don't want to make people, we don't want to risk, I don't know. I think we're beyond that. I think with all we've got going on in this country now, all the absolutely berserk stuff that's going on, and that's not going to go away 4 weeks from now. It doesn't matter how the presidential election goes. The hornet's nest has been knocked out of the tree, and things are going to get ugly and uglier. if that's even possible. But it is. But remember and take heart in that history tells us over and over and over that when the oppressor is feeling the breath of the oppressed on their tails, they go crazy. That's how you know they've lost. They've already lost their power. It's falling apart, and they know it. And they're lashing out. But if we can just stand firm together, shoulder to shoulder, back to back, whatever it takes, we will win.
Thank you.
Well, this is Mama Condi. I want to say one thing to you, sweetie. Everybody here can tell you, I as a rule, never stand in high cotton with white folks. But you, I would.
Hey, man.
You, I would. Because my idea of a white person who claims to like black people or whatever is one who is willing to stand up and face their skin privilege, challenge it, and challenge the system under
That's
which
right.
they benefit, and we
That's
fall
right.
into a demise. So I thank
right.
you very, very, very much just for being. I thank you.
Well, I thank you and all the people like you, Mama, who all through the years have honored me by teaching me how to be a better person, how to see the truth, how to tell the truth, how to do something even if I'm scared. I tell my students, you don't have to not do something just because you're scared. You can do it. You better learn how to act whether you're scared or not, or you spend your whole life scared and you do nothing about anything. I'm scared. I kid you not. When I came to Louisiana, I thought they were going to take me out in the woods and nail me to a tree. I thought that so much that I actually said it in public. I was that afraid. But as it turns out, so far, knock on wood, there's a niche for me here. But I also, and I do not say this lightly, it might sound a little eclectic, but I believe that the ancestors take care of me. I said that, I mentioned that in my book at one point where I said that I was pretty well told by people, black and white, that weren't alive when I was writing it, that nothing was going to happen to me until I finished that book. And since then, I have learned to believe that I walk with a multitude of witnesses, but that doesn't mean I'm safe. I know that any given minute they could come and get me, and I have stood in front of a classroom and said, if they come and get me now, I will have said, I want you to know that the last words on my lips were, I am a revolutionary. And you can't be a revolutionary and be white supremacist. And if you don't know whether or not you're white supremacist, you better ask somebody. And you better be ready
well,
for
Rebecca,
the answer, too, because on any given
we
day.
We can go on.
We are.
We, you know, in the interest of time, everyone, this is such a great discussion, great dialogue this evening. I am just beyond elated at the wisdom and the conversations and the questions and all of the great discussion. I know I will take so much away from these conversations. Definitely, Rebecca, stay in close contact with us as we organize for this march. Definitely tune in. We'd love to have you back on our show. And I know you have talked so much this evening, but I've got to ask you just one last question. I've got to get your thoughts about this upcoming march on Washington.
If I can figure out how to be there, I have to be there. I just have to figure out a way. Now, the only reason that I said it like that is to say this, because I think this is a moment in history that must be, you know, we just need to do this. We need to do this. But I also have a commitment to an organization starting in 3 weeks that I will be the president of a national sociological organization. And one of the things that we have to do is decide where to have the conference. And I've already decided, so we're going to Havana, Cuba, for our conference next year, the Association for Humanist Sociology is. And so that's gigantic, and it takes a lot of backflips to pull it off, needless to say. And that's the first week in November after the August march. So I'm going to be on thin money in August because I don't get paid in the summer anyway, but I am prepared to get there, whatever I have to do. So if I have to ask for a birthday present of a flight from here to Washington, I hope you'll look for me in the crowd because I'll be having to sleep in my suitcase, you know. But I would love to meet all of you there, and I need for myself to stand with all of you in the face of this wonderful moment of all of us coming together, because the work you're doing right now on social media with that, the Facebook work you're doing, classic. I mean, you've got people from every state weighing in. It is beautiful to watch. I mean, it is breathtaking. It just leaves me feeling like, man, we were pikers. Look at them go. I'm proud to know you.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. We are proud to know you as well. And I know that you have your blog. If you could remind our listeners how to check out your blog and any other ways that we can stay in contact with you, I'll allow you to share that with us and our listening audience.
All right. My website will get you to everything. That's RebeccaHensley.com, one word, RebeccaHensley.com. But my blog on race is called Why Am I Not Surprised? And it's 10 years old, so if you just Google Why Am I Not Surprised, I'll come up. The name I use on the blog is Change Seeker, so if you Google that, the blog will come up. And my Twitter name or handle or whatever you call it, I don't know what you call it, that's how old I am, is In Your Face Woman.
I like that. In Your Face Woman. Well, again, I appreciate all of that. Rebecca, we hear the whole team. I'm sure the listeners appreciate you being up here this evening as well. In the interest of time, I do would like for us to get right into some last-minute updates. I see that we do have some callers on the line, but in the interest of time, again, it's such a great discussion. We kind of got, you know, away from our time frames here, but definitely, Rebecca has left ways for her to be contacted. So if you have things specifically for her, please check her out in the means that she's mentioned. If you have questions or things that you'd like to just say in general to the No Shackles Radio team or discussion topics, be sure to email that information to the Millions for Prisoners March at gmail.com email address. A few updates lastly. I wanted to make people aware of our newsletter situation. So many of you have signed your loved ones up to begin receiving the No Shackles newsletter. That newsletter, the first edition, did go out on last month. I've also posted this on the Facebook page. So some of you have already started to do this, but we are getting pushback from some of the facilities. And so it's really been hit or miss. Some facilities, the newsletter has been going into just fine. Other, family members, et cetera, are reporting that their loved ones never received the newsletter. And so we are in the process of trying to collect data to determine, you know, is it an institutional problem? Is it a content problem? But we are doing our part on our end to get that straight. So, again, that's the update on the newsletter. The newsletter is scheduled to come out again for this month here. I'm sorry I said October before. I meant September. Now we're in October. So if you would love for your loved one, a prisoner that you know, to receive the No Shackles newsletter, please send their full address to the Millions for Prisoners March@gmail.com email address, and also use that same email address to report any sort of, you know, if your family member did not or loved one did not receive the newsletter, we want to know that information as well. So I did just want to update you with that. Nextly, the local representatives, I want to thank all of my local representatives, if our local representatives, if they are on the call this evening listening. These people are doing great things out there in their communities. They are definitely getting the people in their areas involved, aware, educated, knowledgeable, and prepared to be at the march in August of next year. And so those are all the updates that I had. I would definitely love to give all of my co-hosts this evening an opportunity to say a few closing remarks. So your line is open, Sister Layla, Brother Malah, and Mama Condi.
Peace. This is Malah Divine Malah. I'm the prisoner's champ. Also, I'm the project manager for the No Shackle newsletter. If anybody got any interesting articles dealing with the prison system, please send it, and I will publish it. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Layla Aziz, and I just want to say this was a great show, Professor Hensley and Mama Condi. Both of your wisdom is because of pushing on this movement, we're going to really lean on you guys to get information and make sure that we're not making the same mistakes and we're pushing the momentum off of the work that's already been done. So thank you so, so much.
And
thank you for that, Layla.
Would you give us two things, please? The university where you work and teach and the title of your book again, please.
Certainly. My book is Reduced to Equality, My Odyssey to Renounce Racial Privilege and Find Myself. And you can find the link on Amazon on my website at RebeccaHensley.com. I am, if you go to my website, you can find everything you want need to know about me, but I can get some blowback from my university by talking about it on the radio, because then they think I'm representing the university, and I'm not allowed to do that. So I'm sorry, but it is the information is available if you go on my website.
Okay. So. One last thing. This is Mama Condi. Is your book in audio book format? I'm blind.
Oh, my goodness. You are going to force me to do that. I did a book on managing diabetes last year, and I did it in audio also, and because I know a manager of a radio station, and he said, you're a natural. You've got to come back and do your race book when you write it, and I've been trying to get that done, but I haven't been able to, and now I have to. So I will be happy to do that, and it might take me I might not get it done till Christmas, but I promise you when I do, if you give me a contact, if you will send me an email or something, changespeaker@gmail.com will get me. It's changespeaker, one word, @gmail.com. I will tell you when it comes out in audio and give you a little link so you don't have to pay for it.
I thank you in advance.
I thank you for the motivation to do it. I meant to do it anyway, and now I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. We have had a wonderful, another exciting episode of No Shackles Radio. I thank my co-host for joining me this evening. I thank you again, Rebecca Hensley. I would actually, I'll end on some closing words that you actually said tonight, Rebecca. It really, you said that the prisoners, they have not been broken. The spirit of the prisoners lives on, and the system has not been able to break the spirit of us here on the outside who care so deeply about our criminal justice systems, the prisoners, the human rights, this whole movement. And so we're a part of this collective, and that's important for us to know. What we do sometimes, it seems like we don't make progress and things aren't changing, but, the spirit is alive. And so thank you all. Tune in next Saturday for another episode of No Shackles Radio. We will be having the People's Platform that, again, is an opportunity for you to call in and share whatever you'd like to share with us, all things prison-related. So thank you again in solidarity with everyone. Enjoy your evening. Peace.
Peace. Good night.
Peace.
When you don't go to Geico.com, car insurance can be confusing. Like Swedish techno confusing.
Bark, bark, meow, meow. Dance with me, purple cow. Bark, bark, meow, meow. Ooh, you lovely cow.
Geico makes it easy. With 24/7 access, all you have to do is go to Geico.com and you could save money on car insurance. It just makes sense. Unlike,
Dance with me, purple cow. I like your moves.
When you don't go to Geico.com, car insurance can be confusing. Like Swedish techno confusing.
Bark, bark, meow, meow. Dance with me, purple cow. Bark, bark, meow, meow. Ooh, you lovely cow.
Geico makes it easy. With 24/7 access, all you have to do is go to Geico.com and you could save money on car insurance. It just makes sense. Unlike,
Dance with me, purple cow. I like your move.